This episode is brought to you by Worldwide Soba. Are you interested in making your own Japanese noodles? Or buying premium handmade soba, udon, or ramen noodles? Learn more at worldwide-soba.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, food writer and director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Keiko Ketsu, who is a third-generation Japanese-American and chef partner at Quality Branded, which owns multiple popular restaurants in New York City, including Quality Meats, Quality Italian, Smith & Walensky, and Park Avenue. And traditional Japanese cuisine has become very popular in the U.S., but we tend to overlook the history of Japanese Americans. So today we'll discuss cultural assimilation of Japanese Americans in the U.S. From the point of culinary issues, and how Craig's experience as Japanese American from California has influenced his cooking style, and much, much more. But quickly before we start, Japan Eats is available on Heritage Radio Network website as well as on iTunes and Stitcher as podcasts. So please go to iTunes or Stitcher and subscribe to Japan Eats, and please write a review on iTunes or Stitcher. We appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatayama.com. Now, let's start our conversation with Craig Koketsu. Hi, Craig. Welcome to Japan Eats.
Thanks for having me.
Great. You are a third-generation Japanese-American. So where did you grow up?
I grew up in San Jose, California, which is essentially an hour south of San Francisco in the Bay Area.
Right. People say that's a heavenly place.
Yeah, it's really... when I was growing up, it was still a lot of orchards. It's a really fertile valley. And so they were growing like tons of fruit, strawberries, corn. And there were, you know, when I was a kid, there were still roadside stands where you can, you know, pull up and get a crate of strawberries and take them home and wash them. And just like, you know, we would just engorge ourselves on fresh fruit. And it's really delicious.
So maybe that inspired you to become a chef. Maybe.
It was definitely a lasting food memory for me because, I mean, on the East Coast here, TriStar strawberries are really delicious, but they're not quite the same as the taste memory that I have of strawberries as a kid. You know, they were just the texture and the juiciness, and they were really big, but they also had this really beautiful aroma and fragrance all at the same time. One of the memories I had when I first met my wife, my girlfriend, I went over to her house, and she also lived in San Jose, and her mother had just gotten this whole big crate of strawberries, and she washed them and, you know, took the stem out, and they were all perfect, and they were in this bowl in this fridge. And we took that whole bowl and we just sat and we were talking and we ate the whole bowl of strawberries, and it's still like one of my best memories.
Wow. So, yeah, I'm sure you impressed her mother.
Impressed or upset. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. It just reminded me about, you know, Michinoeki. In Japan, it's a basically local farmers market. It started to pop up throughout the country, and it's generally it's like a collection of local farms.
Right.
And then I think it's relatively new, so if you travel throughout Japan, you can try to find the Michinoeki and the station near stations or, you know, all those highway drives. And then I think they really help you to create that kind of taste memory.
Yeah, yeah. Those little things really stick with you for a long time.
Right. Yeah. So when you grew up, what was your perception about your identity? More Japanese or American?
It was certainly more American. I was very aware that I was Japanese, you know. Most of my friends were Caucasian growing up, so it was, you know, visually apparent that I was different from most of my friends. And certainly the culturally, we were very Americanized.
Mm-hmm.
My family, I grew up in a family of six kids.
Wow.
And so we were the typical American family. We just happened to be Japanese.
Right.
But the cultural aspect of Japan was something that, my mom really strived to educate people about. And so when I was a kid, she was instrumental in starting a Japanese-American summer school.
Oh, wow.
In San Jose, called Suzume no Gakko, and which became sort of a model for a lot of Japanese-American summer schools, cultural summer schools throughout the country.
Mm.
And she was one of the founders. And then she was also one of the founders of Nikkei Matsuri, which was the springtime festival in downtown San Jose, which is one of the only Japan towns in the United States, really.
Right.
I think there's one in San Francisco, one in L.A., and one in San Jose in California.
Mm. So she had some kind of concerns that you or, you know, the whole community may not have enough experience with Japanese culture?
I think so. I think she wanted us to learn more about it and be proud of it. And so that was certainly something that, for me, I identified with. And that was a big part of, even though I was an American kid, it was a big part of my identity.
Right. I think even nowadays, a lot of Japanese communities have weekend schools to teach.
Right.
Yeah, I think it's probably more for exams when they, just in case they go back to Japan and things.
Exactly. I failed miserably on all this. Japanese class and everything. Oh, man, it was just so hard. I had no knack for the language.
Like, why am I doing this? Right. So, yeah, but since you are the third generation, I'm interested in your grandparents who came from Japan. So may I ask when and why your grandparents came to the States?
So my grandparents, well, my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, was actually born in the United States, and then she went back to Japan, and then she came back to the United States.
Mm.
My other three grandparents were all born in Japan and immigrated to the United States, in the early 1900s. And, you know, I think like many immigrants, they came here for more opportunity and a better life.
Mm.
And they settled in California ultimately, and as with many Japanese immigrants in California, farming was a big part of what California was then and still is, and so they, you know, they took up jobs in farming. I just found out that my maternal grandfather and grandmother had a restaurant shortly.
Oh,
so,
really?
Yeah. I didn't realize that, but they actually cooked. And my grandmother was always a really amazing cook, and she could whip things up, and the kitchen was always clean and organized, and it looked effortless. And I didn't realize that sort of came from her experience as sort of a professional cook, where she had to cook for a lot of people, and she was a young she was actually before she was married, she was responsible for cooking for a lot of laborers.
At the farm.
Yeah. And
wow.
So it was pretty interesting to know that was sort of, you know, part of who I was, mm. and maybe one of the reasons I was drawn to this industry.
Yeah. Right, DNA.
Yeah.
Right. But assuming she was cooking Japanese cuisine, right?
Yeah, yeah, mm. yeah.
Right, and just the farm, fresh farm produce, and then cooking Japanese cuisine.
It's beautiful. There's nothing better. My dad's parents had a garden. Actually, both my grandparents always had a garden. Mm. And so some of the best memories were of them just, you know, during the summer, pulling out zucchini, pulling out cucumbers and tomatoes from the garden and whipping something up mm. very simply. And just eating that fresh produce from the garden.
Right. Yeah. Wow. Okay. And, well, by the way, your last name, Koketsu, is so unique that I looked up, and then the name originated in around 10th century. And your ancestor most likely worked for one of the legendary shoguns, Minamoto no Yoshie. Yeah, so we've got a noble family.
That's yeah, related. It's interesting. Yeah, I know that our name is very uncommon. It's very uncommon in Japan, and it's even less so you know, here. And I always think that if there's a Koketsu somewhere in the world, we must be related, you know,
totally.
Somehow. You
right,
know,
so. And it's mainly from Gifu Prefecture.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah,
and then the spelling of Koketsu, is I can't even spell it. It's so complicated.
I have it. I carry around a little card. My mother's father was a very talented calligraphist. Mm. And so he would do the Japanese calligraphy, and he spelled out Koketsu for me so I could show it to people
wow.
and show how it's written, and most people can't even read it.
You know? I don't think I could.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, so your grandparents came here, so, you know, the experience of becoming a citizen or, you know, resident here, do you know the experience, how it was like?
I think, you know, pre-World War II, there was a lot of opportunity, and they were able to, you know, work their way mm. Up and, you know, buy land, and they had farms, mm. and my dad's parents, you know, had a lot of land in Southern California.
Okay.
And they were doing well, I mm. think, before the war, and... Right. You know, working hard on the land, but it was something that you know, that they had come to the United States for, was the opportunity and the ability to do that.
Right.
And so I think, yeah, I think pre-war, they did very well.
Mm, yeah. Okay. But I'm wondering, I'm sure that, you know, Japanese food, like your grandmother cooked Japanese cuisine, right? So were there any easy pantry items, of Japanese pantry items that back then? I'm sure they have to make themselves or something like that.
Yeah, I remember a lot of pickles, mm. you know. Right. There's a lot of Japanese pickling, you know, just salt and, you know, and pressing them and then letting them just sort of pickle in their own, in the juices that you know, accumulated in there, and
right.
then she would jar them up, and we'd have them for, you know, for the following year.
Mm.
So there was a lot of stuff like that. There was, you know, your common Japanese condiments, soy sauce, mm-hmm. miso, and things like that.
Right. So she really maintained that kind of traditional style of Japanese cuisine.
Yeah, I think so. It was very simple cooking. Mm. It was not like elaborate.
It's not a kaiseki.
No, it wasn't kaiseki. But it was seasonal, you know. It was cooking with what they had in the seasons and preserving things for you know, mm. the seasons where there wasn't anything.
Right. Okay. So, but when we talk about Japanese Americans in the States, I think we should touch on the influence of the internment camps during the World War II. So I assume your grandparents went to... camps?
Yeah, actually, my grandparents and my mom and dad were all interned when my mom and dad were, you know, quite young at that point.
Mm.
But their families were all interned during World War II.
Mm.
And it was something exceptional for the Japanese on the west coast of the United States.
Mm.
You know, because the internment didn't really happen outside of that area, even in Hawaii. Where the attack happened,
mm.
They didn't intern the Japanese Americans there, or in the Midwest, or on the East Coast. So mm. it was something that was very specific to the West Coast Japanese American experience.
Because they're more wealthier, maybe more successful.
You know, ostensibly it was deemed military necessity by by the U.S. government, and because they thought there was an immediate threat to the national security. But you know, what actually happened was, my grandparents lost everything, basically their land. They sort of had to forfeit it. It wasn't that the government necessarily took the land. It's just that they were, you know, basically being imprisoned, and they had to give up their land or sell it, and they had no choice. And at that point, you know, they were selling it to people that knew that they had no other buyers. So you know, they literally were giving their land away, and that was a shame.
Yeah, I didn't know too much about what happened, but then I looked up, and then there is an article about one of the camps in Oregon. So this is funny that despite their illegitimate persecution and the harsh, cramped, and sanitary conditions of the camps, residents tried to reconstruct their lives behind barbed wire fences and guarded towers. And at that place, the camp, Minidoka, people grew flowers in the dry soil and formed musical groups, published a newspaper, played on sports teams, developed crafts, and seized opportunities to leave their confinement.
Yeah, I think they reacted very well to a negative situation and really made the best of it. And I know my parents, because of the age that they were when they were interned, it was sort of an opportunity for them to, you know, they got to play, you know, all their friends were sort of close, you know, in barracks that were very close. And it was a sort of a fun environment for a lot of young kids. And the parents really tried to do as much as they could with what they had. You know, I can't remember. They were talking about different recipes that they were able to make with the food that they were given, you know, like powdered milk and stuff like that.
Right.
You know, that
was interesting.
But to this day, my dad cannot drink powdered milk. It makes him gag because it reminds me reminds him of what they had in camp. But yeah, I think overall it was very, you know, they made a very positive situation out of something that might not have been.
Right.
Otherwise.
That actually reminded me of, 2011 tsunami.
Right.
And in all those crazy the shelters,
right,
they
exactly.
had organized, you know, systems to keep maintaining it clean and equal.
So, yeah, I actually went to Tohoku with a group of chefs led by Daniel Ballou after the earthquake and tsunami, and we went there and we fed over 2,000 people.
Wow.
And it was amazing because all these people were displaced and they gathered at this, what was this rugby field basically that has this track around it. And we set up on one side of the field, we set up basically these tents, and they just, in this very organized fashion, they just all sort of came through the tents and got all the food, and nobody was like pushing, and it was just so organized and so respectful, and it was pretty amazing to see.
Yeah. That's what the Japanese people are good at. Right. And it's interesting that you said that, you know, actual camp condition maybe bonded Japanese people more closely to each other.
I think so. It's a lot of people that are similar to you, and, you know, similar culturally. And so it was a time where everybody could, you know, in very close proximity, physical proximity. So,
and culturally, probably they reinforced awareness of Japanese culture, especially for children.
I think so. I think so. But then the unique thing that happened, I think, post camps was, you know, and post war, was this sort of assimilation of the Japanese Americans back into, you know, the American culture. And you know, it was hard because I think for a lot of them, they felt that they were identified as outsiders, and that's why they were put into camp. So after the war was over, it was really more of an effort to have people identify you as an American.
Right.
You know.
Mm.
And so a lot of that sort of had an effect on the Japanese, specifically Japanese Americans on the West Coast.
Mm. So do you know something changed, say, regarding what grandparents did? Like,
yeah, I think it was just, you know, I think maybe largely I think the language was lost.
Mm.
You know, obviously, okay. It was lost on me because, you know, my parents didn't speak Japanese to me. Mm. And they barely speak Japanese now.
Okay.
So, you know, when they went back to schools and everything, they really lost that that part. And when you lose the language, that's a big part,
right,
of the culture, right?
Mm.
So, and then it affected food, too.
Oh,
you know,
okay.
I think a lot of American products found their way into Japanese cooking. And as, you know, as the generations went on, you know, from like, you know, second to third and third to fourth, you know, the connection to the real authentic Japanese cooking was sort of filtered through, you know, all these American products. And
right.
And so that's sort of my Japanese American experience.
Mm. So that's a good segue. So so when you grew up, did you eat a lot of Japanese food or not so much?
Yeah, I mean, we ate what we thought was Japanese food, but then, you know, when I went to Japan, I realized, wow, that is not, you know, that's not what we ate was not a real representation of Japanese food. It was certainly Japanese flavors, but it was, you know, it was definitely put through several filters,
right?
You know,
interesting. And because nowadays you see more real Japanese than
yeah,
ever.
definitely. There's a, you know, there's a return to this authenticity of, you know, regional cuisine wherever it may be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, you know, I think it's ironic, but I'm Japanese American. I think people think that I know about Japanese flavors, but there's so many, you know, Caucasian chefs out there that have actually spent time and worked in Japan and have an understanding of Japanese cuisine,
right,
much, much, much deeper than mine.
So. Mm, interesting, yeah. Right? But I think your kind of perception of being Japanese is stronger than probably more than Japanese in Japan.
But I'm sorry, but
yeah, you know, like, you know, Japanese. I grew up in Japan, right?
Right.
I didn't even question my identity. Like,
okay, yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
you know, DNA. It's like,
right,
really Japanese. But if you are always compared to other, you know, people,
right,
or any other ethnicity,
right,
you become more aware.
Yes. Yeah. Definitely.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, when you're surrounded by people that are like you, you don't really realize that there's any difference.
Right.
You know, or you're different in any way.
Mm-hmm. Well, and your mother's efforts to educate you, that kind of thing is more. And I think regardless of, you can just go to Japan, you can learn traditional cuisine. But
right.
In your mind, I think it's very much more deeper rooted.
Yes. Yeah, I
right.
guess so.
Mm-hmm.
It was sort of interesting the first time when I went to Japan that, you know, I was surrounded by people that look like me, and that was the
right.
first time in my life, so that was sort of odd and comforting at the same time.
Right. Yeah. If you go to Harajuku, like, everybody, like, is black. Right. Okay. So, yeah, but how did you get into cooking, by the way?
Jeez. I started, this goes back to when I was a kid, but I always loved food. I loved being in the kitchen. And being the youngest of six, my parents were really sort of lax about, you know, me being in the kitchen, standing on a chair at the stove and cooking and playing around and baking. That's really how it started.
Mm. And your mother cooked a non-Japanese food, mainly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's a really good cook. And so we grew up with real food, you know, and tasting real food, which was nice. And so I think that's really instrumental in your development as a cook, is having that sort of background of real cooking,
right,
you know, even as simple as it may be, you know.
Right. Well, some people say my mother never cooked, so we decided to become a chef. But
right, and that also happens out of necessity. You got to feed yourself, or else, you know. So yeah.
Right. So, but then, how did you train yourself to be a professional chef?
So, I was in college, and it was at that point when I realized that I really wanted to pursue cooking. Mm-hmm. So I was working in a produce market in North Oakland, California. Mm. And we had great produce, but a lot of chefs would come through.
Right.
And I learned a lot about produce there, and I was able to actually teach a lot of the chefs about what the produce was and how it tasted, and you know, and it, I developed a rapport with a lot of these people, and eventually I went to work with one of the chefs, and that's I sort of apprenticed, and you know, I thought it was great because I was learning, even though I was making like I don't know, you know. At that time, it was like $4 or $5 an hour or something crazy.
Right.
But I was like, at least I'm getting paid for it, and I'm not having to pay for culinary school, you know, and I'm learning on the job. So, and that's really what it was. I started washing dishes and worked my way up through all the stations in the kitchen.
Mm. And so that was the Martha?
Yeah, that was at that restaurant called Martha's in Campbell, California.
Mm-hmm.
And the chef was, his name was Steve Chan, and he was Chinese American. But he actually worked for his chef was this gentleman named Otto Sommerhalder, who had come up through this sort of classical brigade system. So his schooling and his experience was very, very classically French.
Interesting.
And so that was sort of was, you know, that sort of was filtered down to me, and I sort of got his experience and this sort of classical French training.
Right.
You know, at this you know, restaurant, small restaurant in Campbell, California.
Mm. And then, well, it makes sense that now you moved on to the restaurant at the Jeremiah Towers.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a legendary Jeremiah Towers.
Jeremiah Tower and Stars. He was opening another location of Stars in Palo Alto, and that's when I went to work there. And that was an amazing experience also. And I got to work with two really amazing chefs there.
Well, but you know, I'm curious though, because Jeremiah his documentary just came out, right? The Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent.
Exactly.
And I haven't watched it yet, but
I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah.
But I can imagine because he was pretty magnificent. He would stand on the line with a glass of champagne, and he would expedite tickets, you know, and he'd be sipping champagne and just so elegant. But you know what?
I hope you do that too.
I every chance I get. He was a really sort of natural chef, and he had a natural way and natural leadership, and he was a very kind person. At least in my experience, you know. There was an issue where I didn't get paid initially, you know, for like the first 3 weeks or something. And so I didn't make a big deal of it. I knew I was going to get paid eventually, but I went to like the secretary, and apparently it ran up the chain to him, and he like came into the walk-in one day when I was like, you know, frantically searching for all these ingredients. And he's like, "Hey, did you, you know, was everything okay with your check? Or did you get paid?" And I thought that was really amazing that a chef, you know, being responsible for as much as he was, actually cared about one singular employee, you know, enough to, you know, to ask them. And I think that's always stuck with me, the importance of connecting with your employees like that.
Magnificent.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And are you going to say that to other chefs you...
So after Jeremiah left, he left for various reasons. I'm not really quite sure, but Joyce Goldstein from Square One took over as sort of like the consulting chef. And so it was a really great opportunity to learn at the same restaurant from two really amazing chefs. And they were stylistically, they're sort of similar. Jeremiah had a much clearer sense of like this American cuisine, you know, he was sort of creating his new American cuisine,
right.
Whereas Joyce was really more focused on Mediterranean flavors, and you know, through the lens of California produce, but both had amazing palates, and you know, it was just really about showcasing the food as simply and cleanly as possible. But with
sounds like your cuisine in a way.
Yes. I mean, it's definitely had an influence on the way I cook.
Right. And then you came to New York, and then you worked actually at the same restaurant, Les Minas, amazing really great chefs, Greg Kuntz and Christian Delivery.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Right. So what was the experience working with them?
That was probably the most amazing experience for me. I saw, when I was still in California, I saw the New York Times food section where it showed, there was a picture of Greg Kuntz standing on this open oven door on his Bonnet suite. Mm. And it talked about this renovation of his kitchen and all this money that was put into it. And I was like, that's where I have to work. I absolutely am going to work there. So I applied via, resume. I sent in my resume. At that time there wasn't really email, so so you couldn't really do that. But when I came to New York, when I moved to New York, eventually I applied when I was in California. And then when I moved to New York, I followed up with the resumes that I sent in. Mm-hmm. And Les Bonnes was the one resume that I was really adamant about making sure landed in the hands of Greg Kuntz. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up sitting outside in this waiting area outside of the restaurant called Astor Court. Mm-hmm. And his secretary came out, and she was this German woman, Helga Meyer. And she was very, very imposing and very upset that I was like, had the audacity to come and try to hand deliver my mm-hmm. resume to Greg Kuntz. But eventually he came out, and he's actually we sat down in the dining room. This was in between lunch and dinner. At least I had the good sense of,
right.
coming in between lunch and dinner. And we sat in the dining room, and he offered me the job, and I started the next day. So,
wow.
Yeah. And so that was amazing. And Gray his cuisine was like unlike anything I had experienced to that point. It was, a combination of, spices and Asian flavors and French technique and French ingredients. And it was just so beautifully done, so sophisticated. Mm. And I'd never experienced that. And things going through so much of a process before they were actually finished, because in California cuisine, it was sort of more about showcasing the simplicity and the beauty of the ingredient itself. Mm. When I came to New York, it was really about like a technique and about, all these little things that you could do to products to make them better and change them in different ways. And that was what Greg Kuntz really was to me. And he opened all those doors to all those different flavors.
Right. Wow, that's amazing. Okay. So let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll talk more about Craig's idea of Japanese cuisine. So please stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Worldwide Soba. Are you interested in making your own Japanese noodles or buying premium handmade Japanese noodles, including soba, udon, and ramen? Worldwide Soba is a Japanese restaurant consulting company specializing in Japanese noodles. Its services include teaching noodle and soup making, recipe development, staff training, and increasing restaurant and management efficiency. Worldwide Soba has provided consulting services to the Patina Restaurant Group, Samurai Papa, Brooklyn Ball Factory, and over 40 other restaurants. The next time you slurp a bowl of ramen, udon, or soba in New York, you may be enjoying noodles made by Worldwide Soba. They make them fresh each day and send them out to restaurants across the city. The founder and CEO of Worldwide Soba, Shuichi Kotani, also teaches classes to chefs as well as to the public, which are perfect for parties or corporate events. One of his most popular classes, soba making, is held every Sunday afternoon, and a tasting is always included. Learn more about Worldwide Soba at worldwide-soba.com.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Chow.
And I'm Amanda Dell.
And we're the hosts of Recommended Reading with Food Book Fair on Heritage Radio Network. Recommended Reading is a show where we talk about what we're reading, listening to, and watching in the world of food media, between ourselves, as well as with our special guests in and around the food world.
Support Recommended Reading and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming by going to heritageradionetwork.org and clicking on the beating heart, and you can become a member today.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Craig Koketsu, who is a chef partner at Quality Bandit, which owns multiple popular restaurants, including Quality Meats, Quality Italian, Smith & Wolensky, and Park Avenue. So you've been working for Quality Bandit, formerly Horse Wall, for almost 10 years.
For more than 10 years,
oh,
I
really?
Guess. Yeah,
oh, wow.
I think, Fourth Wall became Fourth Wall in 2007, and I became a partner in 2008. So I've been with the company since 2003 when it was Smith and Wolensky Restaurant Group. And so it was, at that time, it was still sort of a publicly owned company. So I've been there quite some time.
Right. Wow. But you don't look... You don't look exactly the same as when we met years ago.
I'm Japanese. Come on, Akiko. You look exactly the same.
Oh, thank you. I have to keep eating Japanese food. I don't know. But you don't. So, right. So what's your responsibility at the Quality Bandit?
So I'm chef partner. What that means is I'm responsible for back-of-the-house operations in all of our restaurants.
How many restaurants do you have now?
So we have soon-to-be 7 in the city, in New York, one in Denver, and one in Miami.
Oh, wow. So yeah.
It's
nationwide.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, it's growing. We were born out of that Smith Wolensky Restaurant Group, which had restaurants throughout the country.
Right.
But I think in that we learned and realized the benefit and value of strategically choosing your locations, and we're really excited about where we are.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So what's your philosophy of cooking at the company?
My philosophy of cooking, I think for our restaurants, is, well, we have a lot of big restaurants, and so there's a lot of different philosophies, but I think my primary philosophy is I want to give people a great restaurant experience. And the reason people come to a restaurant is because they want an experience. They don't want you to cook food that they could cook for themselves at home. So there has to be something interesting about the food you're cooking, and it has to be obviously delicious. But in a big restaurant, that has to also be very consistent and producible,
right,
on a large scale. And so a lot of that is about creating systems and developing methods and standards that will ensure that the customer experience is always as positive as could possibly be, even at a very high level of volume.
So it's a little different from Lespina's experience.
Yes, yeah, exactly. It's a different restaurant model. But we do have smaller restaurants as well. We have Quality Eats in the West Village, and it's only about 55 seats. It was a fun... That was sort of like a fun opening for me, because it was so, in so many ways, it was so easy because it was so small. But you could cook a little differently. It's a little more free because it's small, and you're not going to get completely slammed where it was a fun departure from the larger restaurants like Quality Meats or Quality Italian or Smith & Wolensky. These are all like 200 seat restaurants that we're talking about.
Probably you can change the menu very often.
Yeah,
somebody's going to panic.
Yeah, I mean, we have a good core menu that is signature and remains there for our customers because that's what they love. But then there's also a lot of seasonal changes that we implement.
Right.
Yeah.
So based on that whole situation, do you have some Japanese elements or any philosophy in mind when you do the menu?
Yeah, definitely. I think those Japanese flavors always find their way into cooking, into my cooking. I think they're just things that, like any experience that chefs have during childhood or growing up, and taste experiences or food experiences, those things really sort of find their way into what becomes your style.
Right. So do you have any example?
I you know, there's a lot of play between sweet and savory in in Japanese cooking. You know, sugar or sweet is used as sort of an element in a lot of savory food.
Yeah, we say sashiseso, like sugar and soy sauce.
Right, exactly.
Right,
and that sort of balance and that balance is really important, and I think it's very interesting. I think there's always an opportunity to present something that's just completely umami and savory and through and through.
Mm.
But a lot of times I like to, and a lot of people identify with those flavors, but I like to twist it up. And so, you know, there's a lot of things that I do using fruit and meat, for instance, because I feel like there's a nice interplay between those two, components and their characteristics. So,
right.
You know, the savoriness and then the sweet acidity from fruit and things
right.
like that.
I mean, it's a sukiyaki, for instance, that's like a sugar and soy based, and then there's a beef in it.
Exactly.
It's
yeah. Classic. So it's not, I mean, so, you know, like I do a flat iron steak with blackberries, for instance, and it just sort of works, and you know, and it's, you know, when you think about it, it's not too different from sukiyaki.
Right, so, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Right, it's like kind of universal comfort food as well.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, but you know, to you, what's the essence of Japanese cuisine?
To me, the essence of Japanese cuisine is a real respect for the product. And whatever it may be, and there's people respect it because I think, especially in Japan, there's you know, people take so much pride in what they're producing, be it, you know, sake or soy sauce, or they're farmers and they're growing leeks, you know.
Right. It's not a joke, it's like generations.
Yeah, I mean, they take so much pride in the product, and I think because of that, people recognize that there's like these products are so valuable. We have to showcase them and do justice to them.
Right.
And here in the United States, I think that's getting to be more of the case again. Mm. You know, people are starting to really respect the products that they're buying, and the people that are producing them take so much pride and effort and time in preparing them or making them or growing them that you really feel an obligation to do that. So I think Japanese food is the primary philosophy is really recognizing the importance of every ingredient and trying to do justice to it.
Right. Yeah, I think I have a perception, like, if you go to, you know, kaiseki restaurant,
right,
the food, one dish is a collaboration. The chefs don't think it's just my dish because it's kind of too arrogant to say it.
Right.
And then they really rely on the relationships with the farmers.
Yeah, yeah.
Even often there's generations long relationships too.
And when there's been so much care put into the product that you're using, sometimes you don't really have to do a lot to it because it's just such a beautiful product.
Right.
You know, one of the times I went to Japan, I was able to go to some farms, and I went to this one farm where they were growing grapes.
Mm.
And it was just amazing how they were growing grapes. You know, it was in this sort of tent, and then there was this big trellis that was about probably 6.5 feet high.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to sort of duck under this trellis, and all the grapes were hanging from it. And the farmers would go around with like these little scissors, and they'd prune these bunches into these just stereotypically perfect grape clusters,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And not only did they look beautiful, but they tasted amazing too.
Right.
But I just thought, man, and everyone had sort of like this paper shroud over the top so birds couldn't pick at them from above.
Right.
And but this was like for like literally like thousands of bunches of grapes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of struck me how much they really take produce seriously, or just anything seriously, and how much care they put into it. So,
yeah, I think people tend to cut the corner, right? But then in Japanese mindset, once you notice, you have to do something with it.
Right.
That's
yeah.
kind of obsessive. Sometimes it's too bad, too much, but...
right. I mean, it's our post-war mentality, you know. It's just about, like, making as much as possible, you know, and... You know, making as much food as possible, and so we sort of lost a connection to what actual food production was about, and farming practices, and like sustainable farming practices, not just like depleting soil and then, you know, and then throwing fertilizer into it, you know.
Yeah, I think that's
chemicals
the,
into it.
Right, that's opinion leaders like, you know, Dan Barber to Michael Pollan, those people really reminding us that we really have to go back before, you know, chemical company led farming practice.
Yeah, our soil is like probably one of our greatest resources in the country. So
Right. So so all of those things included, what's your plan from now on?
My plan is to continue working in this industry because I love it. You know, it's so dynamic and so multifaceted. So, you know, there's people, there's food, there's creativity, there's business, there's everything. It's just like all wrapped into one job. And I love it. You know, for the company, we're looking to grow and continue to grow. And we have a lot of great people working for us. And it's great to be able to grow with people that have been with you and to be able to give them opportunities to grow with you. So that's, for me, that's my plan.
Okay. And you have the DNA to be in this industry from your grandmother.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. I gotta follow it through.
So. Okay. So good luck with the many projects that you're working on right now.
Thank you.
And for the future. So, and thank you for joining us today, Craig. All right, listeners, so if you'd like to know more about Craig's cooking and the project, please go to qualitybranded.com. And if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for guests or topics of the show, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or akikokatema.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Monday, so always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher's podcasts. And please go to iTunes and Stitcher and write a review. I really appreciate your feedback. And today's show was made possible by Worldwide Soba. And our engineer is David Tessiore. And thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.